Hello, and welcome to In Conversation With, a podcast from The Lancet Oncology. It's May 2024, and my name is Dr. Cheryl Reeves. This month, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. James Schultz from the Department of Public Health Sciences, University of Miami Miller School of Medicine, Miami, USA. Dr. Anna Patricia Ortiz from the Departments of Biostatistics and Epidemiology, University of Puerto Rico, San Juan, Puerto Rico, and the Division of Cancer Control and Population Sciences, University of Puerto Rico Comprehensive Cancer Center, San Juan, Puerto Rico, and Dr. Leticia Negueda from the American Cancer Society, Georgia, USA. They're going to talk to us today about their personal view entitled Protecting Caribbean Patients Diagnosed with Cancer from Compounding Disasters, published in our May issue. Welcome, everyone. So my first question is, why are cancer incidence and mortality rates increasing throughout the Caribbean?
Well, I think I can maybe address that. Hi, my name is Ana Patricia Ortiz. I'm a cancer epidemiologist. I'm a faculty at the University of Puerto Rico Comprehensive Cancer Center and the School of Public Health at the University of Puerto Rico. I think that there's multiple issues. Let's first think about COVID as a barrier, right? Before the COVID pandemic, you know, there were already systems that were very compromised and overwhelmed in the Caribbean region. And COVID is an example, right, of an event that created an additional stressor within the healthcare system in Caribbean countries, which, you know, we know has affected not only cancer screening, but it's also going to have an impact, you know, in cancer burden, you know, into the future, for example, cancer mortality. So systems, you know, populations that already had barriers in terms of access to care, I think that access to care is a big issue, especially when you have many island states and, you know, there has to be transportation across islands to be able to receive services. That's a big issue for the region. In addition, it's important that countries have cancer control plans. And we know that there has been barriers in terms of developing appropriate control plans and also implementing them in the region. We also know that cancer risk factors have increased across all populations. So the Caribbean is also similar to many countries worldwide where increased risk factors. So for example, aging of the population, increased obesity, tobacco consumption, you know, there's many risk factors also within the population that are going to have an impact in terms of increased incidence of cancer, but also in terms of mortality, issues of access to care are going to be a big problem here.
So can you explain what the unique challenges of people diagnosed with cancer in Caribbean small island developing states are?
Well, I think, again, in terms of access to care, is the issue, first of all, let's think also of socioeconomic status. Many islands in the Caribbean are not necessarily rich countries, right? We're talking about many that are poor countries and also colonies of bigger empires, you could say, worldwide. So there's going to be limitations in terms of resources within the healthcare system. In terms of number of providers, for example, number of specialists that are there available to provide services in terms of cancer prevention, but also in terms of timely access to care. Once you have a cancer diagnosis, how quickly you can get access to a specialist, right, that can develop an appropriate health care plan for you. How timely it is that you can get your appointments is going to be important. Also, in terms of diagnosis, early diagnosis is very important to prevent complications and to prevent that you have a cancer and it's diagnosed at advanced stages. And also, just if you think of the prevention, how quickly you can get an appointment, let's say, to get a mammography or to get a colonoscopy. And once you get the result of that mammography or that colonoscopy, if there's an abnormal result, how quickly you can get an appointment to your specialist. And again, when you have countries that have limitations in terms of the infrastructure of facilities, in terms of number of providers that can give you a timely follow-up care, I think that's where, you know, the complexities arise. And again, it's not that easy as you can take a car, maybe drive to another state if you're in the U.S., is if you have to maybe take a flight or a boat to another island where maybe the specialist is residing. And again, all those issues in terms of access to care are going to have an impact in terms of timely access to treatment that is going to be very important, not only for early diagnosis, but also for survival.
So what are the added challenges for people diagnosed with cancer in the Caribbean, small island developing states following climate-related disaster hazards?
That's the special focus of our paper, right? So thank you for bringing that question. Is how all these compounding disasters, you know, combine with the socioeconomic realities of Caribbean countries and Caribbean states and make it even, you know, more complex for the people that reside in that region. So we know that we are, you know, placed in areas that we are very at risk, for example, for hurricanes, for extreme heat, and other, you know, weather hazards related to climate change that, again, get more complicated because of the situation of, and the politics of the region. And that's why, you know, we are so concerned in terms of developing appropriate cancer control plans and their implementation and their follow-up within the region, where we can determine ways where we can mitigate, you know, the impact of climate change in island states. Also, flooding is a big issue in the region besides hurricanes and extreme heat. And again, if we use flooding as an example, let's think of the fact that when you have flooding, you also have not only hazards that occur for the people when their houses get flooded, but also think of all the toxics that may be in the environment that then when you have flooding, you know, may move towards populated areas, for example, where people live. To give you an example of Puerto Rico has multiple Superfund sites. Superfund sites are defined as areas that are very contaminated in terms of the ground because of previous industries, for example, that were there. And when you have flooding, all those chemicals that are in the ground are also going to go into the water systems, right? And to the rivers and then, you know, reach areas where people live. And then you have an exposure that maybe we're not going to see the cancer occur the next day. But those children, those families living there are going to be exposed to something that may develop a problem for them into the future. So flooding is an example that can have an immediate event. For example, for cancer patients, how they can, if the facilities where they get treatment get flooded, or for example, if their houses get flooded, what's the impact on their quality of life, but also in terms of potential future cancer risk into the future for those families. So now I'm going to let my colleagues elaborate.
Oh, that's my favorite question as well. So I'll be happy to elaborate. One of the ways to think about this is that climate change alters the frequency and behavior of extreme weather events. So that makes it harder for communities to prepare and respond to increasingly unpredictable circumstances, right? So increased water capacity, for example, that happens when there's warmer air, it holds more water vapor, then it rains more, then it floods more. And that increases the risk of exposure to floodwaters that has a lot of these contaminants that can be carcinogens, but also especially concerning for cancer patients and survivors, because cancer treatment can weaken our immune system, which increases our vulnerability to infections, which are common during flooding events. Another example is that some chemotherapy agents, for example, can inhibit thermoregulation. So that makes it harder for patients in survival to regulate their body temperature during the extreme heat that frequently happens in the aftermath of a hurricane or just during a heat wave. And in addition to the logistic issues that residents of the Caribbean territories experience by having transportation challenges, right, between one island and the next, there is this socio-political, historic, and current challenges, including historical extractive colonialism and imperialism, that shapes the limited access to resources in the region. So while if you are in some countries, you think during the heat wave, I can turn the air conditioning on, that's not available to all people everywhere. So those are some of the factors that make it especially hazardous for people who have been diagnosed with cancer to face these climate change-driven hazards in the Caribbean. Jim, you should chime in too.
So one of the things that readers of the article might not pick up on immediately is that the first five of our authors are all from the Caribbean. And that was very intentional. And in fact, we start with Ana Patricia Ortiz and James Ospedales, very well known in public health throughout the Caribbean. And we also have got an environmental health specialist who is a colleague of Dr. Ortiz as well, and that's Dr. Mendez Lazaro. And so we've got some really good people from the Caribbean, but we've also added some other expertise. And so we very intentionally use the word compounding disasters, mentioned earlier, because actually both Marshall Shepard and myself serve on the National Academy's Committee on Compounding Disasters. And that's really an important thought that goes into our presentation of our article, because what we're finding is that with climate change, and Dr. Noguera is such an expert in that cancer-climate change connection. But what we're finding with atmospheric scientists and environmental health specialists who are also on the paper is that climate change is certainly worsening. It is accelerating. But in addition to that, we've also got this sequential set of events that take place. Already mentioned was COVID, for example. And also what we find is compounding can be taken in two ways. Not only do we have sequential events that can be very, very harmful, and very much known to Puerto Rico was the back-to-back Irma and Maria impacts back in 2017. But we've also had situations where now we have the overlay of COVID. So we did a lot of response to Hurricane Dorian from University of Miami, and that basically shut down. People had been moved from the Abacus Islands to other islands because of displacement due to the hurricane. And just as they were beginning to start to do some recovery, COVID literally stopped all movement. And there was basically no inter-island travel for a period of time. And so these compounding disaster events are really particularly hazardous. The other element of compounding disasters is that individual events are really sort of cluster hazards. So what we know is that climate change is making hurricanes, for example, stronger with higher peak wind speeds and rapid intensification, and wetter. In fact, the water hazards are particularly harmful. We've already talked about how they affect contamination, but also just that combination during the actual impact of storm surge and wave action, deluging rains, heavy precipitation, inland freshwater flooding, as well as coastal flooding. These events are really impactful. And then what Dr. Mendez-Lazaro has really been able to explain for us is that quite often afterwards, you have heat that moves in several days later. So you've got hurricane, you've got blackout, and then you've got heat waves. And then the hurricane itself is this cluster of hazards itself.
And I think that it's very important, James, that you mentioned blackouts, because that's another example in terms of how the timeliness of recovery in Caribbean states, right? When sometimes when you have an extreme event like this and there's a blackout, maybe in countries with more resources, in a couple of days, people are going to have power again. But to give you Puerto Rico as an example, also after Hurricanes Maria and Irma in Puerto Rico, which were in September 2017, people were over 6 and 8 months without power. This applied to their houses, but this also applied to the healthcare system. And maybe a physician in a rural community, maybe he didn't have a backup generator to be able to operate the clinic, right? And there was no gas because we're in an island. So it was very hard to be able to get gas just to be able to get that generator running. You know, in the hospitals, they were operating with, you know, the cell phones, with the flashlights when the generators went down. Because, again, they couldn't run 24 hours, the generators of a hospital, for 6 months. You know, so that gives you an example of also the capacity of quick recovery after an event that can be limited in areas with limited resources, like happens in many Caribbean states and territories. And that's also going to have an impact in terms of access to care and also treatment interruption. We have data that shows for our region that there was treatment interruption, and that also actually had an impact in terms of patient survival. Because for a cancer patient, interrupting that treatment is very negative in terms of their outcomes of the treatment of their cancer person.
One specific example as a spin-off of your comment is that one of our authors, Iram Gai, at Washington University in St. Louis, actually worked very, very closely with Puerto Rico to be able to refractionate the sequence of radiation therapy after the shutdown of power in the blackouts throughout the island of Puerto Rico. In fact, that actually became a document that, number one, was used as an astro, a specific astro document and guideline. And it was actually then used again when COVID took place. We've mentioned that in the paper as well.
Can you describe potential solutions and strategies that can currently address disaster adaptation and cancer control?
Yes, there are several. Maybe I'll speak to one of them, and I know Ana Patricia, Dr. Ortiz, also has an example about lodging during emergencies that can be extrapolated for times when there are no disasters. So one of my favorite examples of solutions that concurrently address disaster adaptation and cancer control, it really is related to the expertise that is generated at these places that are impacted first and worst by the hazards of climate change. Caribbean residents and residents that other areas that have been struggling with environmental justice have already recognized that climate change and cancer share a common root cause, and that is our reliance on fossil fuels. So, for example, Hurricane Maria exposed the shortcomings that are associated with relying on diesel power emergency generators, right? The electric grid collapsed, and then you had, as an alternative, these diesel power generators. However, you needed electricity to pump diesel from the reservoirs into the generators. And also, diesel, just like anything else, relies on the supply chain and needs to be transported. When transportation was disrupted to Puerto Rico, you couldn't get diesel to the island. The backup generators couldn't work. Even when they were working, relying on diesel power emergency generators increased exposure to hazardous air pollution in the surrounding communities. If you've ever seen one of these running, you know just how dirty they are. So since Maria, recognizing that this reliance on fossil fuels and on a centralized power grid might not be the best strategy, there's been a movement to shift towards these microgrid systems that can be managed locally and stabilize the electric grid for the entire community. CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services in the United States, which provides these guidelines for who gets paid, so people pay attention, right? Healthcare providers and healthcare centers pay attention to the CMS rules. Since this experience in Puerto Rico, has issued a waiver previously to receive payments from CMS, the only accepted source of emergency power was diesel power generators. Since this experience, CMS has released a waiver, and now microgrids are also an accepted alternative for emergency power generation. So this shows how the expertise that is generated in these communities that are being impacted first can then be relevant and help communities everywhere to do better by reducing exposure to pollution, finding a more reliable electricity source, and stabilizing the grid for the entire community, which is especially relevant as we know blackouts are becoming more and more common. Right?
Well, as an example, I want to bring, you know, going back to the need of, you know, cancer control plans. First of all, that these cancer control plans have to recognize the existence of climate change. And have to take into consideration how we can develop, how can we can better prepare, right, for these events. So, if in the past, when we look at cancer control plans, climate change was not a topic concern, right? So maybe that plan was considering early screening, early detection of cancer, timeliness to treatment. But now again, we are promoting, right, that cancer control plans within the region recognize climate change, and we know there's a great movement worldwide to do so, including, you know, the World Health Organization. PAHO is very interested also in climate change topics and understanding the impact on human health. So again, there's going to be many vulnerable populations to climate change. We're all vulnerable, including patients with other chronic diseases. But for us, a responsibility to think about it in the context of cancer, right? And again, vulnerable patients and also cancer prevention, which applies to all of us. So again, it's an issue of recognizing its existence, being able to develop plans that are well coordinated, not only taking into consideration the healthcare system, but also other support agencies such as the government, community organizations. How can we all be aligned? And that's exactly the purpose of a cancer control plan. It's supposed to consider all the sectors of the community that are important in cancer prevention and control efforts, and we can delineate plans and actions that are going to help us be prepared, but also that are going to serve to mitigate rapidly or response into an event. And this applies, for example, to radiotherapy centers, you know, how they can continue to function without interruption in an event. How can vaccination centers that, for example, provide HPV vaccines and vaccines that are also related to prevention of diseases, including cancer, can continue to provide services in an event like this. So again, it's an issue of coordination and communications that has to be multisectorial across all sectors of the communities that are involved. And also, like Leticia mentioned, that part of also rethinking, you know, our systems or infrastructures, we cannot commit, you know, do the same errors of the past in terms of relying on the same sources of energy and constructing our houses in the same areas, that because we now have areas that have changed in terms of their risk. Maybe you had areas that were not flooding areas, but we have seen in extreme events that now they're becoming flooded. So we have to rethink even the infrastructure of the countries, right, of the settings, and make changes that are planned and that make sense. And this has to be in an immediate term, but also for the long term, because this is not going away. And again, maybe we have to predict, you know, from what we have learned, how we can be better prepared and what things we have to change. So in 10 years, in 20 years, you know, our capacity to respond is efficient. And if we continue to experience new hazards, so we can quickly adapt, you know, to be prepared for those hazards. It cannot take us a year to adapt or a year to recover, like we have seen in the past in our countries. This has to be better planned so it can be quicker and more efficient, and at the end of the day, you know, save lives.
Well, one more element that we mentioned in the paper that could certainly get built into the cancer plans themselves, but much more into practice, is most of the cancer centers now have support services. And so the mental health aspect is a very important one. So when you're dealing with blue sky days and no major heat, hurricane, or other hazard, even so, you have people who are dealing with their cancer diagnosis, with the debility from their cancer, with the side effects of their treatment, with possibly foreshortened life expectancy. And so these are all stressors in their own right, specific to cancer. Now, when you then build in the overlay of heat on a daily basis, and we have a diagram in the paper that actually shows the extraordinary degree of heat in recent years, where record-setting temperatures day upon day extending for almost a year. And then at the same time, when you've got periodic extreme events and major hazards like hurricanes, when you're dealing with just the preparedness for a major impact, actually surviving the storm itself with special needs because you have cancer, and also in the aftermath, particularly with island states having power outages and other situations that are more severe and acute in island nations, these heaped upon each other stressors are a major issue. So coming up with ways to actually support patients and caregivers, but not to forget, this is extremely stressful for the persons who are providing care. And we too often leave out the providers and the staff and the people who are actually working in the cancer centers. And so this, with increasing severity of climate-related hazards, with compounding disasters, the mental health aspect is very important as well.
I think that's very important, the mental health topic, again, for patients and for providers who also are overwhelmed because of the situations. They have their own families too. And I also wanted to highlight the importance of emergency preparedness plans for the individuals per se. You know, we have to educate the patients on the importance of having an emergency response plan for themselves, for their household. For example, they need to have copies of their medications, of their treatment plans, because in the event of relocation, right, because they have to leave their house, if they go somewhere else, they need to be able to have the information of, you know, of their cancer, of the treatment plan that they're receiving, so they can continue that plan. I mean, they don't have access to that, which was something that we observed during Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. People were relocated to the U.S., but then some of them didn't have the information of their of their disease and their treatment plan. And again, they had to be brought back because they couldn't really do anything with them. So that's just an example of also educating not only the providers, but also the patients of the importance of, it's not only where I'm going to meet with my family in that case of an emergency, if I have my medications, if I have my proper documentation, my health insurance card, and information that is going to be very relevant for me to be able to continue treatment into the future. And those are the types of details that also should go in cancer control plans, right? When you talk about the goals and objectives, you know, giving that type of details of how we also need to work with the patients so they can empower themselves, you know, for these situations.
I think that is so important because too often, you know, when you first started out talking about this, you were mentioning we need to have patients do these personal, individual caregiver disaster plans. We're actually exploring that with our own cancer centers here as well. But I think what you were getting into as you evolved that comment was the fact that increasingly we would like the cancer centers and actually the medical centers even more broadly to take an active role in supporting their patients. So it's not just a good luck, you should have this plan sort of a scenario. It's actually taking active steps. And part of that, and there are considerable innovations in patient communications to guide people, not just during disaster days, but actually during heat days or other hazard scenarios that are becoming increasingly frequent.
Totally agree. It has to be a team effort between patient and providers, and patient-provider communication has to be very strong and robust in order to make that work efficiently. Thank you, James, for elaborating that.
Yeah. So how difficult and how long will it take to implement any potential solutions and strategies?
I think that work is being done and progress is being done, but, you know, it's going to take, you know, additional efforts, you know, of all sectors, because again, these things take time. But go ahead, Leticia, please elaborate.
I agree completely. Yes, it's a continuous effort too. It is not a once and done. As climate change continues to change the frequency and behavior of extreme weather events, as we continue to understand how these climate-driven disasters impact access to cancer care, cancer risk, cancer outcomes, as we develop this knowledge, it will be a continuous process, right? And really, efforts to fix the unbalanced distribution of resources that we inherited from colonial times will be a substantial, super important here, because it will allow for the development and implementation of these climate change and cancer control solutions, starting in the Caribbean and then beyond the Caribbean, right? As we talked about before, some of the solutions being developed in this region are relevant everywhere. And I think there is an example of the United Nations recently creating this loss and damage fund that is one of these instruments that could then facilitate the development of implementation of these solutions far ahead into the future. And I hope that we have talked and shown enough that this expertise being generated in these under-resourced regions is relevant globally, right? Necessity is the mother of invention, is the say. So we see that these areas that have been restricted due to sociopolitical, historical, and current discriminatory policies and practices are leading the way when it comes to innovation. And having the resources necessary to test and implement these and then spread the word, as you were saying, spread what you've learned from developing and implementing emergency preparedness plans, how to communicate with the patients, how can healthcare centers be more proactive in emergency preparedness and response, how can we stabilize our electric grid. All of these lessons, right, are going to have to continuously be modified and implemented and advanced, and having the resources available to move that in a more equitable and efficient way is crucial globally.
Describe some of the challenges which may still lie ahead.
I think they're going to continue to be structural challenges that are not easy to be resolved because of lack of funding, you know. And again, if we go back to COVID, you know, the whole healthcare system got distracted, right? Because it was overwhelmed with COVID. And that was a stone, you know, that we had in recent years that, again, we're going to be seeing the impact in the next year. So I think that was something that became an additional burden. But again, the fact that access to, you know, the best infrastructure, the best technology, the best equipment for cancer patients is a challenge worldwide, right? To be able to have access to the best technologies. So again, the whole socioeconomic situation of the region is a barrier. Then again, it's something we cannot fix from one day to another. But what we can do is, again, have these plans that help us mitigate the situations. Because again, we have to work with what we have. So I think that's going to continue to be a challenge because, again, of the economic situation worldwide and in the region. But again, climate change is not going to stop because of anytime soon. It's going to continue. Like Leticia mentioned, it's a continuous process where even things are going to continue to develop in a way that maybe we don't know at this point, right? There's many predictions, right, of extreme heat continue to increase, you know, more extreme events. But again, the compounding, you know, events that are going to be affecting us is something that we have to learn from what we have experienced and try to plan the best that we can into the future and not use the socioeconomic situation as an excuse because there's anyway many things that we can do if we are well prepared. And again, working with the infrastructure that we have at this point. So it's more about strengthening our infrastructure in terms of communication, coordination, because we have great health professionals and healthcare professionals in the region. It's more about trying to help them overcome, you know, the system level barriers or the infrastructure barriers that can occur and how we can overcome them for the reality of our patients. And again, for the best care for our patients.
I believe too that one of the challenges is this biased perception that climate change is going to be a problem in the future for those people over there, right? That some of us are safe due to where we were born or where we live nowadays. But really, climate change is already here. The hazard is already happening and none of us are safe. All you have to do is look at the recent heat waves in Europe, for example, right? So understanding that providing the resources Dr. Ortiz was talking about that will facilitate the development and the implementation of these solutions, this innovation, in the places that are being impacted first and worst is a return on investment on us, right? It's not charity. It's the right thing to do because we're all in this together and we're all going to be impacted. So the more knowledge, the bigger the pool of solutions that we have, the better we're all going to be. Because I agree, climate change is not going anywhere.
And just one more point, this has been so well said, but I think the issue here is we were sort of complacent about the fact that, you know, there's sort of like this gradual warming and we've gotten very used to thinking this is just going to kind of creep along and we'll somehow adjust. But I think 2023 temperatures, you know, just off the charts, as you see in figure one in our paper, is really a wake-up call that sometimes you have this quantum leap where every day after day is a record-setting heat day, where you've got just extraordinary storms that are spawned by this. And I think the issue is that we cannot avoid the fact that we're really crossing critical tipping points, okay? Not just temperature numbers, but basically in terms of human physiology. You know, we're working with patients with cancer in this particular focus, but at the same time, we're looking at heat at the level that is unphysiologic for entire populations. Throughout Central America, for example, outdoor workers are now dealing with what has sometimes been dubbed as Mesoamerican nephropathy. We're looking at widespread population-wide kidney disease, where kidneys being the target organ for heat stress are happening throughout the population. So this isn't just hypothetical. This is actually affecting whole populations, but more specifically, patients with cancer are even more vulnerable.
Thank you so much, Dr. Schultz, Dr. Ortiz, and Dr. Nageda. It has been a real pleasure chatting with you today. Thank you for listening to this episode of In Conversation With. Remember, the full personal view is now available online on the Lancet Oncology website, and you can subscribe to In Conversation With The Lancet Oncology wherever you usually listen to your podcasts.